For best man, Charlie had tapped his old drinking buddy, Field Marshal Abu Ghazala, the defense minister of Egypt. Wilson's great friend, the high-placed Israeli Tzvi Rafia, would maintain a low profile somewhere in the crowd. There was no telling how many mandarins of the CIA and the Pakistan Intelligence Service would be in attendance, but there would be many. And all of Charlie's angels would be on hand, along with Baron Ricky de Portanova, the Baroness, Charles Fawcett, and Joanne Herring, the Christian godmother of the Muslim victory. Listening to Wilson describe the guest list, it suddenly dawned on Gust what Charlie was doing. Here on this magnificent stage on the roof of the world, he was planning to unveil all the secret cast of characters who had played leading roles in the great drama he had just produced, the players who had changed history. And to make sure that the world got the message, he invited me to come along with the 60 Minutes camera crew. It all might have happened if Charlie hadn't gotten careless a couple of weeks later. He had flown to California to serve as the Grand Marshal in the annual Mule Day Parade, an honor recognizing all that the congressman had done to enlist Tennessee mules in the great anti-communist jihad. But early that morning, when Sweetums called Charlie's hotel room, Snowflake answered the phone. It was the end of the affair. There would be no wedding at the Khyber Pass, no parade. It was also the last time that Wilson or anyone else would even think about publicly glorifying the Afghans. Charlie had planned a victory parade, but in truth, the Afghan war hadn't ended. The Soviets were gone, but their puppet government was very much in place, as was the CIA's Afghan war budget. This was the beginning of the dark side of the Afghan adventure. Throughout the war, Wilson had always told his colleagues that Afghanistan was the one morally unambiguous cause that the United States had supported since World War II, and never once had any member of Congress stood up to protest or question the vast expenditures. But with the departure of the Soviets, the war was anything but morally unambiguous. By 1990, the Afghan freedom fighters had suddenly and frighteningly gone back to form, re-emerging as nothing more than feuding warlords, obsessed with settling generations-old scores. The difference was that they were now armed with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons and explosives of every conceivable type. The justification for the huge CIA operation had been to halt Soviet aggression, not to take sides in a tribal war, certainly not to transform the killing capacity of these warriors. It was a turning point that demanded a re-evaluation. Someone in the U.S. government needed to take the lead in charting a new course. For a brief time, Wilson looked as if he might assume the role of statesman. His model for enlightened leadership had always been the man who led America during and after World War II, when the United States defeated and then rebuilt Europe and Japan with the Marshall Plan. He proposed a billion-dollar U.S. aid package to begin rebuilding Afghanistan and did his best to rally support. At the end of that first year, he set off for Moscow to see what could be done to end the surrogate war that continued to rage. The Russians were pumping an estimated $3 billion a year into Afghanistan to prop up the puppet government led by Najibullah, while the CIA, with Saudi matching funds, maintained the enormous flow of weapons to the feuding warlords. At his meeting with Andrei Kosarov, the future Russian foreign minister argued that the United States and Russia now had a common interest in stabilizing Afghanistan, and particularly in preventing radical Islamic elements from taking power. The Soviets' preoccupation, Kosarov explained, was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Mujahideen leader who had so impressed Joanne Herring and whose close ties to Pakistan's ISI made him the leading recipient of CIA weaponry. Kosarov insisted that Gulbuddin's brand of militant Islam was just as dangerous to America as it was to the Soviet Union, a point Charlie had heard frequently that year from his own side. What struck Wilson most on his visit was not Kosarov's reasoned appeal, but the discovery that, whatever the sins of the communist regime, the people of Russia had been liberated. He witnessed the explosion of religious faith after years of repression, and he attended a daring production of the musical Hair in the Union Hall of a cigarette factory. But everywhere, the scarcity of consumer goods shocked and saddened him. This, he realized, was a defeated nation. When Charlie returned to Washington, the men running the CIA's Afghan program were alarmed to read an interview in the New York Times that presented him in a dovish light. Wilson says they immediately descended on his office to whip me into shape. They complained about the interview and said it looked as if I had traded in my hound dog for a poodle and my pickup truck for a BMW. Beyond the jibing, Wilson says that the Saudis, who had just honored Charlie, expected the United States to hold firm in its support of the Mujahideen. It was sad to see how quickly Wilson's effort at statesmanship collapsed. He found that it wasn't easy to stop what he had started. He was a politician and a dealmaker, and as he put it, "I had asked the Saudis and the CIA to run with me. When they told me what they expected in return, I decided to go along with it. I didn't have the old fire and zeal, but I knew I had to pay back." In the second year after the Soviet withdrawal, Wilson delivered another $250 million for the CIA to keep its Afghan program intact. With Saudi matching funds, the Mujahideen would receive another $500 million to wage war. The expectation was that they would join forces for a final push to throw out the Soviet-backed Najibullah regime, restore order, and begin the process of rebuilding. The agency even sent word to Wilson that as an act of gratitude for the renewed budget, the Mujahideen planned to take Jalalabad on June 1st, Charlie's birthday. It didn't happen. Instead, the Najibullah forces held, as the Afghans bickered and disgraced themselves by massacring prisoners. That year, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, adding insult to injury. Gulbuddin and Saif, the Mujahideen leader closest to the Saudis, whose men had guided Wilson into Afghanistan for the 60 Minutes shoot, both publicly sided with Hussein against the United States. Their subsidies, however, continued. With the news from Afghanistan growing darker, Charlie escaped so deep into drink that he began attending sessions of the congressional chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous. No member of Congress had ever acquired a position of such towering influence over the CIA as had Charlie Wilson at that particular time. He was consulted on every aspect of the agency's dealings with Congress, and incredibly, at the same time, he chaired the committee that served as the congressional watchdog over the CIA. At best, though, Wilson was operating on automatic pilot, rarely attending the special briefings the agency put on for him and refusing to meet with the Mujahideen when they came to Washington. It was almost as if he didn't want to see or hear what was happening to his old freedom fighters. Finally, on April Fool's Day, 1991, there was good news from the front, very good news. Wilson learned that his favorite commander, Jalaluddin Haqqani, had liberated Khost. The first major Afghan city was now in the hands of the freedom fighters, and it was in no small measure due to the introduction of a series of lethal new weaponry that had come out of the Wilson's Weapons Upgrade Program. Soon after, I accompanied Wilson's administrative assistant, Charlie Schnabel, to meet up with Haqqani and take stock of how the Mujahideen were conducting themselves as they began to reclaim their country. The stories we heard once we reached Pakistan were alarming. The Mujahideen were hijacking the AID trucks, making regular runs impossible. At Friday prayers, the mullahs were inflaming their followers with accounts of Western NGO volunteers teaching Afghan women to wash with soap. An enraged mob had marched on the facility that provided free health care to women, now convinced that the clinic was promoting free sex. They burned the facility to the ground and trashed 17 cars, $1.8 million in damage in just one day. Afghan women working in refugee camps as teachers and nurses were threatened. One had just been kidnapped and murdered. In Peshawar, the American consul relayed a particularly horrific account of one of Gulbuddin's many outrages. A few months earlier, he had sought to liberate Khost by shelling the civilian population of the city. Thousands fled their homes, and the embassy, sensing a massive humanitarian crisis, dispatched medics from the cross-border program to care for the wounded and the refugees. As diplomat Janet Bogue told us, "The U.S. government now finds itself giving guns to a friend who shells civilian populations, and then we turn around and send in a humanitarian mission to deal with the refugees created by our own investment."